Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out the Here We Still Stand live stream link. That's right. The Here We Still Stand conference is going digital. It's going to be all online this year due to COVID-19. But, you know, initially we were kind of bummed, but I'm starting to get more and more excited as we figure out what we're going to do. We're going to try to make it a real good experience for everybody. So Chad's involved. All the plenary speakers are involved, and we're going to build something that we think will be enjoyable for you guys right from your living room or from your church. Hey, if you guys are getting together in small groups, get your small group together on that Friday and Saturday, the 16th and 17th, and you can act like you're at a conference together, you know? Just potluck, Here We Still Stand conference all day. It's like a Super Bowl party in October. So get that done. You can sign up. That's all you got to do. It's free, Chad. Chad says it's free for the whole world. All you got to do is go over there and type in your email address, and when the time comes, we will send you a link to watch the whole thing for free. So no excuse to not make it happen. You got to do it, guys. You'll be able to watch it from your phone, watch it from your desktop, pop it over on your TV. You'll be able to do whatever you want with it. So join us for that. I'll put a link in the show notes. So if you go to the show notes, I'll put a link for you to sign up to watch the Here We Still Stand live stream. Ironically, we're talking about Christian freedom. So it's a good thing, while you're feeling less free probably than you have in a while, to know that the Christian still free in Christ. The freedom that matters, you still got it.
Were you making a cultural reference there?
I was just saying that we're not free to assemble in that way right now. I'm not saying that we should be free or not, or we shouldn't be free to assemble that way. I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm just saying the fact is you're not free to assemble 500 people in a conference center in California. Can't do that. But you are free, my friend, and that's what we're gonna be talking about. The freedom that really matters, Chad.
It's always a good idea to talk about freedom.
Yeah.
In any context whatsoever.
Yeah.
But certainly today, and certainly in the Christian context. So yeah, it's gonna be good.
Yeah.
My presentation is ready. It was ready for Germany and Sweden.
Yeah.
Just need to expand a little bit and we're ready to go.
Yeah, looking forward to it, man. So yeah, make sure that you join us. Tell your friends, you know, maybe some people that wish that they would come out to the conference with you or start, you know, listening to some of the material or hear some of this stuff. Well, now you have an opportunity for them to check out a bunch of stuff, and it costs nothing. So invite them over and watch it together. All right, Chad, we're here in 1 Samuel. We're at the very end of chapter 3. We didn't quite finish it. Samuel's got his word from the Lord. Samuel told that word to Eli. It's a tough word. Eli accepted that word as from the Lord, which was a pretty faithful move on his part. And we're going to hear a little bit about Samuel, and then we're going to leave him alone for a while.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we're gonna hear about him for about 3.5 more verses, and then we're going to say adios for about 3 chapters.
Yeah.
So he's going to disappear from 4, 5, and 6 and reappear in chapter 7, verse 3, which, as we'll talk about in just a minute, is actually quite explicit. It's like his absence there is on purpose. So we'll talk about the significance of that in just a second. But let's wrap up his story at this point. So as you mentioned, he's called now. He's given his first word of the Lord to Eli. It was a hard word, but he said it. And 19 through 21, which wraps up chapter 3, is just more or less a summary of the impact that Samuel started to have on Israel. So Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail, or as the ESV has it, let none of his words fall to the ground. We've seen that expression before.
That'd be a nice thing to have said about you, wouldn't it?
That'd be a pretty good epitaph, wouldn't it? Yeah.
None of his words
fell to the ground.
That's pretty good. I feel like some of my words have fell to the ground.
Yeah, I feel like mine have too. And not in the positive sense of like seeds growing or something like that.
No, there's some words that I prefer that they fall to the ground, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I this just just popped into my mind, but I guess that our English expression, like if someone gave a talk and it just, you know, it just didn't do well, we might say something like, you know, that presentation kind of fell flat, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't stand upright. In other words, it's similar, I suppose you could say to this Hebrew idiom that, none of his words fell to the ground. So they accomplished that for which they were sent, to use a language of Isaiah. And it says that his impact was not just local, but it was all over Israel. It said all Israel from Dan even to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. This geographical designation of from Dan to Beersheba is pretty common throughout the Old Testament. I guess we would say something in America, we would say something like from New York to California.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. So it's just grabbing the two cities on the northern and southern borders and using those as a designation for the entirety of Israel. So everybody, in other words, knew that Samuel had been called and confirmed as the Lord's new spokesman. Which is significant in the big biblical picture, because this means that another Moses has arisen. We haven't had another prophet like this since the death of Moses. And quite some time has passed since the death of Moses. We've had a lot happen in Israel's history. And so now Samuel comes along, and he's going to be Moses number two. Not quite on the level of Moses, but at least another mega prophet in the list of prophets in the Old Testament.
Yeah, I mean, in this sort of language of everyone accepting him as that, that's a pretty unique position. I mean, even some of the other prophets, you don't see this sort of universal acceptance of them. I mean, there's sometimes these prophets are prophets and nobody wants to listen to them and no mm-hmm. one's paying any attention to them. It doesn't seem like it's that way with Samuel. It seems that when Samuel speaks, people are listening.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they come to him and they want a king in a few more chapters. So they realize and they accept more or less that he indeed is the one that the Lord has chosen, as opposed to, for instance, just to contrast him with one prophet, just think of poor Jeremiah.
Yeah. He didn't have this universal acceptance from Dan to Beersheba. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. People weren't going around saying, "Hey, listen to Jeremiah, man, he is the Lord's prophet."
Yeah. Let's go and quiet.
Be like, no. I'd be like, throw that sucker in a pit. You know, we're tired of listening to him. That's what happened to poor Jeremiah. Samuel might have had the greatest, popularity isn't the best word, but I guess we could say like universal acceptance as a prophet.
He had a high approval rating.
He had a high approval rating compared to a lot of the other prophets. And then the closing verse of the chapter says, the Lord appeared again at Shiloh. Because, I love this language, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. It's fascinating language. We talked about this last time, that this Devar Yahweh, the word of the Lord, which appeared to Samuel, wasn't just, you know, some voice that boomed out of the heavens, like in a search for the Holy Grail or something. This was the appearance, the visible, tangible appearance of God. But in that context, he's called the word of the Lord. And we discussed that last time as the Son of God. This is one of the ways in which he was revealing himself to his people of old. But it's summarized beautifully in this closing verse by the Lord revealed himself. Well, how did he reveal himself? Well, by the word of the Lord. So if we were to use New Testament language, we would say, and the Father revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by his Son.
Yeah.
More or less. That's what's being said.
Same way he does for us, Chad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yesterday, today, and forever, right?
Well, this is the thing. It's interesting that, you know, for Samuel, it doesn't say that that God revealed himself by the writings of Moses or the law or anything like that. It just says that he was revealed by the word. And this is the same way that he reveals himself to us. I mean, we can learn some stuff about God through other things. You can learn some stuff about God, or at least that there is a God, according to Paul, just by looking around. You can know that there is one, but you can't know a whole lot about him. And you can go to the law and you can learn a little bit about him, but you're not going to really understand God the way that God wants you to understand him apart from his word coming to you. And that word, of course, as John wants to start out his gospel by establishing that word that it, that all through the Old Testament, whether it's coming to Moses or it's coming to Samuel, that word is Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Old Testament basically prepares us for John chapter one, right?
Yeah.
The word of the Lord came to Samuel. The word of the Lord came to Moses. The word of the Lord came to this prophet or that prophet. The word of the Lord is always showing up. And then all this was a preparation for the time he showed up and stayed.
Yeah. Right? The time that he tabernacled among us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He assumed our humanity and did not just kind of unclothe himself of our humanity when he ascended into heaven. He still is fully human and will be for all eternity.
Yep.
I got all this like forefront of my mind because I started another book last week.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. I did take a 1 week break.
That's good.
The end of one week to the next. But anyway, I'm writing about this chapter that I'm writing now is about these various appearances of the word of the Lord, or the glory of the Lord, or the messenger of the Lord in the Old Testament. So, yeah, all this is at the forefront of my mind right now. All right. Then we hear one more thing about Samuel, and this is the beginning of chapter 4. It says, thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now, I suspect that this is another false chapter division. So that first sentence in chapter 4 probably should have been the last sentence of chapter 3, but be that as it may, that's going to be the last time that we hear about Samuel. Chapters 4, 5, and 6 are usually called the arc narrative. There are some, I don't buy this, but there are some more critical scholars who believe that this actually existed independently as its own narrative at some point, which is like incorporated into 1 Samuel. I suppose it's possible. It is kind of a standalone story. But I don't think it's in any way necessary to believe that. This is crafted as a standalone story within the context of Samuel, because it is what you might call a mini Exodus story. This story is going to be all about the Exodus or the exile of the Ark, or you could also say the exile of God. For yeah. Israel,
and I mean, you do need it. I mean, you need this story to have things make sense later on. It would be weird if you didn't have this context.
Yeah, there's a lot in here which is going to prepare the way for everything that we're going to read about in the rest of Samuel. This is a fascinating case, and we'll get more into the details as we go along with the story, especially in the chapters 5 and 6. But this is a great example of what we've seen a lot of different ways so far in the Old Testament, but I don't think we always make it explicit. There's various ways to describe what's going on here, just from a biblical perspective. Sometimes it's called intertextuality. Sometimes it's called inner biblical exegesis. There's different names that are used for it, but more or less what's going on is you have a recycling of an older story that's told in a new sort of way. So this is a retelling of the Exodus story. You see this repeatedly in the scriptures, where something will happen, say an exile will happen, or something like a river crossing or a sea crossing, which then gets used and then reused and then reused. So the basic elements of the narrative get adopted into a later narrative. We saw this in the case of Abraham's exile and return to Egypt being the paradigm for Israel's exile and return from Egypt. And we're going to see it here, because what is more or less going to happen is there's going to be an exile, except this time it's not Israel, it's God and his ark going into exile. And there's even language which is explicitly referring back to what happened in Egypt. In fact, the Philistines talk about what happened when Israel was in Egypt. So the Philistines know the story of the Exodus, and they're going to talk about it in chapter 4 and then in chapter 6. God is going to plague these people who have taken him captive, and eventually they're going to let him go, and he's going to return with their gifts. So the whole structure, basically, of the Exodus story is going to be duplicated here. Now, the reason this is so important is because, as I said earlier, this happens in a lot of different ways, and it stretches all the way into the New Testament. So time and time again, when you're reading the story, you're going to be like, when you're reading the biblical story, you'd be like, oh, man, this really seems familiar to me. Well, there's a reason it does. It's because this is an old story told in a new way. And then you get to the New Testament, and all of this becomes abundantly clear because you have story after story connected with Christ, which is more or less him using an Old Testament paradigm in order to do his ministry or to teach in a certain way, to get a point across. So anyway, this is one example of this intertextuality, interbiblical exegesis, where the Exodus story is going to serve as a paradigm for what's before us. So what happens? Well, the Israelites and the Philistines are going to have a couple of different battles. The first one starts out like this. It says Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle, and they camped beside Ebenezer, while the Philistines camped in Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. And when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. So we've been dealing with the Philistines for a while now. They have emerged as the dominant threat to Israel. And they're going to remain the dominant threat to Israel until finally David takes care of them once and for all. But if you remember from early in the Judges, we dealt with Ammonites, with Amorites, with the sons of the east, all different sorts of people. And then gradually, the Philistines became the ones who were the main threat to Israel. The Philistines lived on the coast, on the Mediterranean coast. Of course, they had influence inland toward the mountainous region of Israel. But their five cities, their Pentapolis, was there on the Mediterranean coast, places like Ashkelon and Gath and Ekron. Anyway, they're drawing up in battle here against the Israelites, and this first battle they win, kill 4,000 of men. Now, what should Israel have done at this point? That's the question. Based on what we have just been talking about, the whole first part of this podcast, if you're going into battle and you get beat, probably, well, you should have done this even before the battle, but certainly now you should be doing it. The first order of business after you've been defeated by the Philistines should be to say, where is Samuel? Go get Samuel, because we need to talk to him. His words don't fall to the ground. He has been confirmed as a prophet of the Lord from Dan to Beersheba. So if there's any situation in which we need to get his advice, and not just his advice, but we need to hear from him directly what the Lord would have us do, well, that time is now. That's exactly what the Israelites should have done. But that is not what they did. So verse 3 says, when the people came into the camp, the elders said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the ark of the covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies.
Now, this seems like something you definitely want to ask Samuel about.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been the kind of question that you should have put to Samuel.
You're like, yo,
what should we do, and should we take the ark?
Let's ask the guy that grew up sleeping near this thing if we should do this.
Yeah, it's like it doesn't even cross their mind. I suppose, and I'm not defending them at all, I'm just trying to get into their heads, but I suppose what they think is that, you know what, we remember that when our forefathers first came into this land and they were going to take on the city of Jericho, what did they do? Well, they took the ark, right? They took the ark and they marched around the city, and they did this for 7 days, and then they had this great shout, and down came the walls of Jericho, and we were able to gain a victory. Well, why don't we just do that again?
Well, there's definitely a pious interpretation of this where you could say, and then one of these guys is like, I know what happened. I know why we lost. We didn't take the Lord with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now this sounds extremely pious. We went out there without the Lord, and this is what happened. So we have to redo it. We'll take the Lord with us, mm-hmm. and everything will be all right. This just tells you that don't get overly pious unless God tells you to.
Right. Yeah, this chapter is very, very similar to, I think it's Jeremiah chapter 7. It's his famous temple sermon. And Jeremiah is taking the people to task because they're trusting merely in the presence of the temple, right? He's got this great line, don't be saying the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, as if the mere presence of the temple is somehow a guarantee of your safety and well-being, because God had made it explicit through Jeremiah that he was going to bring the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem and to destroy the temple along with it. So these Israelites in this context are saying basically, the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Covenant. That's all we need, and we'll be fine.
This must not have been, I guess the Nazis and Raiders of the Lost Ark didn't read this chapter when they were going after the Covenant. They're like, if we just have the Ark of the Covenant, we'll be unstoppable. I'm like, well, that's not how the Ark works.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a feeling biblical literacy wasn't high among them.
apparently not.
Yeah. So as it turns out, the Ark does the Israelites no good. And when the Philistines get a hold of it, it does them not only no good, but much harm. So careful.
I guess Raiders of the Lost Ark got that one right.
Yeah, they did get they at least got that one right.
The back.
It's interesting. It's interesting too that when it's referred to all three times, so verse 3, verse 4, verse 5, it's called the Ark, not just the Ark, and not just the Ark of the Covenant, but the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. So 3 and 4 and 5 all refer to it that way. And I suspect what's going on here is sort of a jibe at them, because they're thinking, okay, we need to get the Ark here. You know, the Ark that's all about the covenant that Yahweh made with us to be our God and to watch over us and to protect us. So if we have that, then everything's going to be okay. As we'll find out, it wasn't. And they not only brought the Ark, but they also, verse 4 tells us that they brought the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, whose days are numbered. So they bring the Ark and the priest and everybody, they come into the camp. There's this great shout, which again is reminiscent of what happened around Jericho. It's such a great shout. It says that the earth resounded. So the earth is shaking because everything is just, everyone's so excited about the presence of the Ark there. And the next section is fascinating to me because it records the reaction, not of the Israelites, but of the Philistines when they hear this. So verse 6 says the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, and they're camped, relatively close to each other. And they're like, more or less, what's going on? What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean? And then somehow they figured out, that this was the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And the Philistines are scared. It says they're afraid because they said God has come into the camp. So the Philistines, for all their faulty theology, they do connect certain things. They realize that the Ark is the throne of God, and so they understand that if the Ark is there, that God must be there. That's the kind of the theological connections that they're making.
Yeah, and that kind of confidence is just intimidating by itself. I mean, at the very least, they're looking at these guys, and if you look at someone and they seem dead certain that this is what's going on, you also might be like, well, this isn't good. Like they seem very certain that they have a game changer in their midst. And that kind of confidence is concerning, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Were I a Philistine in this context, I would be scared too. I mean, because you hear what's happening in the enemy camp, and as we'll find out in just a minute, they know the history of Israel. They know exactly what the God of the Israelites has done in the past to the enemies of Israel. So they have every reason to be frightened about what might happen next.
I remember growing up, there was when I was a teenager, I was playing basketball in some outdoor courts, and there was this really little guy. He got really upset and wanted to fight me, and he just was coming at me and was like, let's go right now. And it freaked me out because he was so confident.
Yeah.
And I had no reason to be afraid of this guy, except for the fact that I'm like, what do you know that I don't know? Like, why are you so, right. Why are you so ready to do this? Why are you so sure of yourself? And it will put some doubt in you. You're like, are you like a black belt or something, man? What's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. There's something about that confidence that can be unnerving.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's precisely what it was happening here with the Philistines. They're like, what do they know that we don't know?
Yes.
And they even say, woe to us. This is verse 7. Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. So, I mean, they've gone against other, I'm sure they've gone against other people besides the Israelites, and they had, plenty of military experience under their belt, but nothing like this. They have nothing to compare this to.
Yeah, and it shows that the Philistines too, they know the Hebrew history, because I mean, they are going to reference here and say, who's going to deliver us from the hands of these mighty gods? Now, they don't know about this sort of singular God. They still are operating
a little weak on monotheism.
A little weak on that, but still, they're like, these are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. So they know, they've heard of this stuff, right? So they're like, man, these gods, are not to be trifled with.
No, nothing to mess with. Yeah. So you would think, given everything they've just said and the reactions, that maybe at this point they'd be like, we need to regroup, and maybe we need to go back to the coast and get some more men, or, something, in other words, faced with this threat. But instead, they do quite the opposite. Here's what they say. They say, take courage and be men, O Philistines.
Man up, huh?
Man up, yeah. Take courage and man up, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight. You'd almost expect one of those Hebrew expressions, so gird up your loins.
Yeah.
Something like that. In other words, don't be cowards. Be soldiers, be warriors, get ready to fight, because if you're not ready to fight with all your heart and give it all you got, then there's a very high likelihood that the tables are going to be completely turned, and we're going to be the slaves, and the Israelites are going to be our masters. So evidently, this Philistine call for courage worked, because everybody fought. Philistines go out, the Israelites go out. And verse 10 tells us that as happened during the first battle, so in this one, Israel was defeated. And it gets worse, though. It says, every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great, for not 4,000 like the first battle, but 30,000 foot soldiers of the Israelites died. And then we get to verse 11. And we hear the really bad news. At least it seems like bad news. It says the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So I said it seems like bad news, and in many ways it is. But this is sort of a Good Friday kind of bad news, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's a terrible defeat. It looks like God has just lost. God's been taken, and darkness is going to settle over the land. We have death, we have defeat. Everything is not looking good, not looking good for Israel. And yeah, of course, there is certainly an element of bad news to this, just like there's an element of bad news to what happened on Good Friday. But of course, when you know the end of the story, it gives a whole new meaning to what happens on Good Friday. And when we know the ending to this particular story about what God is going to do during this time of his exile, then we realize, oh, okay. So God did know what he was up to here, because he is allowing himself to be taken in order that when he is taken, he can just completely decimate his enemies. Yeah. This is a setup.
Yeah, God is fine on his own.
Yeah, God. God is fine on his own. He doesn't need the help of the Israelites. And he's about to show them what he's able to accomplish for them. Now, this is when you look at the entire story about what happens after this, this is really an act of mercy on the part of God, unexpected mercy. Because what did Israel deserve? Well, Israel deserved, according to the curses, covenant curses way back in Deuteronomy 28, to go into exile themselves, right? That's one of the threats that God leveled against Israel. If you abandon the covenant, which clearly Israel had done, then I'm going to exile you to a far-off country. You're going to be slaves to these foreigners. Well, what happens here is Israel doesn't go into exile. Instead, God himself goes into exile. He goes into exile with his ark. So he's going to exile on behalf of his people, so that while he's there, he can do for them what they completely failed to do for themselves. Yeah, they go out to battle twice and get defeated. God lets himself be taken in order that he can be victorious against his enemies.
Yeah, I've always thought about when the ark gets captured is like the death of Christ, and what they're about to do with this. You're about to, if you want a picture of like what was going on in the tomb, when Jesus goes down to hell. Well, this is you're going to get that picture.
Yeah, yeah, that's precisely what's going on here. So
you're about to see a picture of Holy Saturday.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, like 1 Samuel chapter 5 could totally be titled the Old Testament Holy Saturday.
Yeah,
that's precisely what goes on. So we will get to that. We have more to cover because we have to finish up what happens with the Israelites. So verse 12 says that there was a runner from the tribe of Benjamin. The ancient armies, they had messengers who were runners. We'll hear more about those in other parts of 1 and 2 Samuel. So you had basically these guys who came back and forth, brought the news from the battle, or they would take news to the people who were in battle. So this guy is a Benjaminite. He runs from the battle line, and he comes to Shiloh that same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. Probably not what you want to see on a messenger. He's running up, his clothes are torn, and there's dust on his head, because that is a sign of mourning. I mean, you want to see him running up with a smile on his face and no dust on his head. So the minute you see this guy running from where the battle had been with torn garments and a dirty head, you know the news is not going to be good. Well, there's Eli. Eli is, we're told in a few more verses, is a very old man. He's 98 years old. And at this point, he is sitting there on his throne by the road, eagerly watching. Sort of I wouldn't say it's an inside joke, but it says he's eagerly watching, but he can't see.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's just like, he's a blind watchman, in other words. So he's watching, but he can't see anything. And it says his heart was trembling for the ark of God. He is not really worried about his sons at this point. Everything in this story seems to say that the main concern that not only he, but also other people have are, what about the ark? What's happened to the ark of God?
You almost think that Eli, perhaps, I mean, we don't know, but it seems like maybe Eli didn't think this was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really worried about it.
Yeah, that's certainly the impression that you get. That compounded with the fact that they've already been defeated once by the Philistines. So he knows that them taking the ark was probably not a good move. It's a huge gamble. And also, you know, he's already received from two witnesses now, an unnamed prophet and then from Samuel. He's already been informed that everything is not going to go well with him. And his sons, right? And he's been told his sons are both going to perish. So chances are he has a pretty good suspicion that this is going to be a dark day for him and for his household. So the man came to tell it in the city. The whole city cried out when they heard the news, when they heard the bad news. Eli heard the sound of the outcry, but he wasn't close enough to hear what was going on. So he's like, you know, what's all the commotion about? So the man, the messenger, came and told Eli everything, I guess, that he had told the people. It says that Eli was 98 years old. His eyes were set so that he couldn't see. So he's old, he's blind, and he's very heavy, we also are told in the minute. The man said to Eli, "I'm the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And then Eli asked the loaded question, "How did things go, my son?" The one who brought the news answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines." He said, "To hold anything back here." He just like lays it on the line. So Israel has fled from the Philistines. There's been a great slaughter among the people. Your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And then, saving the worst for last, he says, "The ark of God has been taken." And when he mentioned that the ark of God, Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was old and heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years.
Now this is interesting, that two things that kind of jump out here is, one, that it's at the mention of the ark that it almost sounds like that Eli had a physical reaction to hearing that the ark was taken. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he starts trembling so violently that he tips his chair over. That's what it seems like, is something like that. Yeah. And then there's this other thing where you have this, Eli had judged Israel for 40 years, which is sort of another transition piece, because we look at Eli as a priest, but here it speaks of him as a judge, right? Mm-hmm. We're very familiar with this language and we went through Judges. And this seems like Eli was the transition from a judge to a prophet. So he's sort of this priest judge figure. But so I think you could say that Eli is sort of the last judge of Israel.
Yeah, I think you could say that too. His whole service is very characteristic of what we've seen in the book of Judges, you know, with corruption and everything else that's going on. And so this is a huge transition point. In more ways than one, it's a transition from the period of the judges. It's also a transition for the tabernacle, because after this moment, the ark of God will never be inside the tabernacle again. In fact, we're not exactly sure what happened to the tabernacle at this point, because there's going to be a destruction of Shiloh. We'll have to get to that in another podcast, but there's going to be a lot of things that are going on at this particular time in history, which are marking a transition. So the judges are over, and we're going to be having a king pretty soon. The tabernacle will soon be over. We're going to have a temple. So this is a huge time of transition in Israel's life. So Eli, he served for 40 years and now has met his fate. Let's go ahead and finish this out. We've only got four more verses. And we're told that there was not just the one death that day, but while all this was going on, this is kind of hard to imagine, but all this stuff is going on. Evidently, the wife of Phinehas is just, she's like full term. She's ready to have her baby, and all of this stuff happening probably just sends her into labor. And she hears the ark of God was taken, and that her father-in-law just died, her husband died. And so all this going on, all of this news causes her to go into labor. She gives birth, and she is about to die herself due to complications with labor, I'm assuming. And the women say to her, "Don't be afraid, for you have given birth to a son." It says she didn't answer or pay any attention. And then she called the boy, well, we used to say it Ichabod. In Hebrew, it would be, it's just Ikavod. So it's basically two words. The E part, which is written as an I in English, and then the kavod is the word for glory. And this can be translated a couple different ways. It can mean it can mean no glory. That little E particle on the very beginning can mean no, in the sense of no glory, no kavod, or it can mean where. It can mean both those things. So Ikavod or Ichabod can mean no glory or where is the glory. But either way, the same message is being communicated, that the glory has Well, my translation has departed from Israel. That could really be translated, the glory has been exiled from Israel. The verb is galah in Hebrew, which very frequently means go into exile. And that's the way that I would translate it based upon everything that we've been talking about so far, and that is coming up next. So the glory of the Lord, that is to say the Ark of the Covenant and everything that it stands for, has been exiled. So then it wraps up the chapter by saying that, quoting her, saying the glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God was taken. So that wraps up chapter four, and that wraps up our 40 minutes. I guess we'll have to wait for next time, see everything that happens. Definitely listen next time, because we've got some pretty we got some comedy coming up here. This is like this is exile comedy.
Yeah, this is dark. It gets a little lighter next episode for sure. All right, join us next week for Holy Saturday in the Old Testament. Going to be good. And sign up for the Here We Still Stand live stream. Link is in the show notes, or you can go over to the website and find all the information there. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you then.